rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Congress is coming back into session next week, and it's the first hour of our of Friday here, noon East time, Eastern Coast time, 9 a.m. on the West Coast. And as we have for going on 3 years now, our first hour of our Friday program has been Congressman Bernie Sanders, now Senator Bernie Sanders. He was the only independent member of the House of Representatives, now one of two independent members of the United States Senate, neither a Democrat nor a Republican, and a real straight shooter, and just pleased to have you with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Also, we take calls during the segment. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, criticisms, complaints, whatever, compliments for Senator Sanders, Senator-elect Sanders, 1-866-440-THOM, 866-440-8466, and you can drop into our live chat room at TomHartman.com. And so we'll start taking your calls right after the break. Bernie, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you here with us. The 4th of January is when this is when you guys start work. What's on your agenda?
Well, let's hope that the 4th of January marks a new beginning for America and a real change of direction in the way this country is going. And I think it's important that we in the Senate, we in the House, begin to stand up and inform the American people and President Bush that the present direction of this country is no longer acceptable. We're not going to do government for the wealthy and the powerful. We're going to start representing the middle class and working people. We're going to bring our troops home from Iraq as soon as possible, and that we're off on a new agenda. It's terribly important that I think the Democrats get out of the box rapidly and boldly and make sure that the American people begin to understand the government can, in fact, work for all of the people and rather just a wealthy special interest. So there's a lot of stuff that is happening. The committees are going to get to work. I think what people will begin to see right away is that for the first time in 6 years, Congress will no longer be simply a rubber stamp for the White House, but investigative committees will start investigations, will start hearings, and will start asking some of the questions that the American people have long wanted to hear. And that means why we got into Iraq in the first place, and most importantly, how we're going to get out as soon as we possibly can. I think you're also going to see some significant progress in a number of pieces of legislation coming down the pike to help families that need a lot of help. For example, it's not just raising the minimum wage, which obviously we have to do. The $5.15 an hour national minimum wage is clearly a national disgrace. I think that will be dealt with quite early. It means taking a look at the higher education bill, which is coming before the committee that I will be on, the Health, Education, and Labor Committee, and saying to the American people that we are going to move forward. It can't be done tomorrow, but we are going to move forward to a day when every family in this country, regardless of their income, will be able to go to college if they have the ability and they have the desire. Specifically, that means significantly lowering the interest loans that college families are now paying. Bush, as you remember, cut back on higher education funding, raising interest rates. We have to undo that and go further in lowering interest loans. But most importantly, we have to significantly expand the Pell Grant program, which is the government scholarship program, which now, because it is so underfunded, only applies or primarily applies to lower-income families, which obviously we have to do, and we have to expand there, but we also have to move it up to middle-income families. There's another area that I will be working hard on, and that is the concept of loan forgiveness. Do you know what I mean by that, Tom?
Yeah, are you talking about like the Jubilee?
Well, no. What I'm talking about is that right now, certainly since Reagan, there has been a real effort almost to make it very difficult for bright young people who want to go into government service in the broadest sense imaginable to be able to pay for that, because they're going to, these young people leave college with significant loans. For example, we have a major crisis in child care and early childhood education. It is a disaster. In cities and towns all over America, all over the state of Vermont, my state, very hard for working class or middle class families to find quality, affordable child care. Very important issue. And yet, if you are the average child care worker coming out of college with a $25,000 loan that you have to pay off, a debt that you have to pay off, you have no debt forgiveness. If you want to go into legal aid, if you want to go into public defender's office, you're an attorney, you want to go into state's attorney's office, pay is very low, there is no loan forgiveness. So what we want to do for nursing, in many instances, it's the same thing. So if we are serious about creating a strong public infrastructure of dedicated, hard-working people who are prepared to work hard to improve the quality of life for the American people, we're going to have to talk about loan forgiveness and making college more affordable.
You know, essentially what you're talking about here is, in reverse, undoing the damage done by the last decade or so of conservative economic policies that have made it progressively more and more difficult to get into college and more expensive to get into college.
Absolutely.
And in reverse.
And then on top of that, you get out of college, you're the average middle class or working class person, you find yourself $30,000 or $40,000 in debt. How are you going to go into education? How are you going to go into child care? How are you going to go into law enforcement? How are you going to go into issues, areas that you may really want to get into when the pay is low and you have a large debt to repay?
Right,
so that discourages. You have to have a lot of money in general. You aren't interested in environmental law, right?
Mm.
You graduated law school. Well, you know what? In most instances, you're going to have a lot of money in your own pocket to do that because the pay scale is so low. So that's an issue we want to work at. We also have got to begin in a very serious way tackling the disintegration of our healthcare system. And a lot of people, you know, have different ideas as how best to proceed. Clearly, the message has got to go out that the United States must join the rest of the industrialized world and regard healthcare as a right of all people. Now, how do you proceed from that big debate? My own view is that America will end up with a national health care program for all people, probably when some individual states go forward and show that it can work, provide quality care in a cost-effective way to all people. I think my own state of Vermont may well be positioned to lead the country in that direction. So we're going to be working on legislation which allows states to get financial assistance, to provide waivers so they could use the public money that's coming into the state in order to provide for a system which is cost effective, which does not have huge administrative costs. We are wasting hundreds of billions of dollars now on bureaucracy and all kinds of advertising that should not be the case, excessive.
Well, we had William McGuire getting a $1.78 trillion paycheck. Or billion dollars.
This is what, from United Health or something?
Yeah. $1,780 million.
Yeah, and that would be a perfect example of the absurdities of this inefficient and wasteful system. The function of healthcare is not to provide this guy, what's his name?
William McGuire.
William McGuire with a $1.78 billion
paycheck.
$1.78 billion going to one person.
This is the second largest health insurance company in the United States and the largest provider of Medicare Part D.
I mean, and that speaks for itself. I mean, we need healthcare dollars to address the crisis of 48 million Americans without any health insurance, the high cost of prescription drugs and so forth. The other issues that people should be paying attention to is that some of us, I can't say all, but some of us in the Senate and the House are prepared to take on the pharmaceutical industry, who have been ripping off the people of this country for years. The immediate job at hand is to rewrite the prescription drug Medicare Part D bill so that we do away with the donut, we negotiate prices, and we develop a stronger prescription drug benefit program for seniors while we save taxpayer monies. The second part, very important, is to push for prescription drug reimportation. You know, you and I talk about unfettered free trade a lot, and many of our corporate friends and many members of Congress have no problem when corporations throw American workers out on the street, move to China, where people are paid 30 cents an hour. That's great. That's called free trade. But somehow or another, we just can't re-import American-made products from Canada, from a handful of companies who charge the Canadian people for prescription drugs 50% or 60% less than they charge the American people or our friends in Europe, the same thing. So obviously we're going to be looking at that. The other thing is that many people don't know in terms of the pharmaceutical industry is the taxpayers of this country through the National Institute of Health and other government agencies spend many, many, many billions of dollars in research and development for new drugs.
It's about $30 billion a year, isn't it?
There is, I don't know that number off the top of my head, but it is a significant part of the total amount of money going into research and development. So the question that we have to ask is, okay, that's fine. I think the American people think that's a good investment. But where does that money go? And how does a particular company, Pfizer or whatever company, AstraZeneca, end up with the product? And what do we get in return?
Right, and they end up with a patent. They get to charge
They end up with the patent.
Prices.
We end up with the highest prices in the world, having paid for the research.
Yeah, there's something wrong with that picture. Bernie Sanders is with us, Senator-elect Bernie Sanders from Vermont, independent member of the United States Senate. We'll be taking your calls for Bernie, our Brunch with Bernie segment, right after this. It's 16 minutes past the hour.
Tom will play on Air America Radio.
Shoe one horse, open sleigh, would come carry me away. But I've been waiting here all day, and one just hasn't come my way. Now, excuse me if I'm not being reverent, but I was hoping for a miracle to hold me, wash me, save me from a righteous doubt as I watch helpless. And everybody sings if it's Hanukkah or Kwanzaa. Solstice harvest or December 25th. Peace on earth to everyone and abundance to everyone.
There you go. Peace on earth to everyone. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour, the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Or at least clean elections. You know, we'd really settle for that. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Speaking of progressives, the founder of the Progressive Caucus in the United States House of Representatives. And Bernie, let's take some phone calls.
Good.
Michelle in Grass Valley, California. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Good morning. It's nice to talk to both of you.
Thank you.
My question is, and I'll hang up after I ask it, is I was really hoping that the two of you could have a conversation about... Is there any talk at all of another independent investigation happening about what happened during 9/11, the day of the planning? I mean, what happened the lead up to it? Because if 9/11 is the impetus, is the catalyst for all of for everything that's happened since then in the administration's policy? I mean, is there any talk at all about further investigation going into what actually happened the day of or the lead up to?
Your thoughts on that, Bernie?
Well, I'm not quite sure what Michelle means. I know that there are a lot of people who believe that somehow the Bush administration was involved in 9/11 or knew about it and so forth. I don't believe so. I think that is, you know, one of the things that has happened in this country, Tom, that concerns me very much is because we have in Washington the most reactionary, incompetent, corrupt administration in modern American history, then people pile on top of that. No, I have not to believe Bush administration was involved in 9/11. I think that's paranoia.
But there is a middle ground. I mean, he had 56 specific warnings.
But that's another issue. That deals with incompetence. If you got a memo on your desk which says, beware, Bin Laden prepared to attack the United States, and you don't respond effectively to that.
Yeah, shouldn't that be investigated?
Sure it should. Absolutely. But that is a different... You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
That there are some people who think that Bush was involved in 9/11 and the attack on the United States. But the lack of... Sure. I mean,
It just seems to me, you know, I've read large chunks of the 9/11 Commission report, and it just seems that there's so much stuff that got left out with regard to all those warnings that we read later about in people like Richard Clark's books and Paul O'Neill's
books. Exactly right. And you know, the fact that intelligence information was coming into the White House and into the Secretary of State's office warning us about the dangers of an attack, of course that should be investigated and looked at.
Yeah. Scott in Freeholt, New Jersey, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Yes, hi, Senator Sanders. I am 24. I am turning 25 next January. I graduated from the University of Delaware in 2004. I am still paying off my student loan. I recently just found my first real job post-college. I obviously don't get health insurance, but my question is, a lot of my peers still haven't found jobs. They graduated. They went 4 years. They aren't bad students, but they're waiters and they're delivery drivers. Is this a trend that you're seeing, or or are we just an anomaly?
No, I don't think you're an anomaly, Scott. One of the factors that government statistics sometimes ignore is that, Scott, now if you, regardless of the job that you're doing, regardless of your qualifications in terms of the job that you're doing, regardless of the pay that you may or may not be receiving, you're going to be simply regarded as fully employed if you're working 40 hours a week. And that often masks a reality that you are talking about, and that is we have people with college degrees who look forward to doing certain types of work at certain types of income who cannot find those jobs. And what that's about, Scott, is that in America, we are losing millions and millions of good-paying jobs, whether it is manufacturing, information technology, and many of those jobs are being replaced by, as you indicate, service industry jobs, waiting, waitressing, and so forth and so on. So I don't think you are alone. The reality is that real wages for millions of American workers are declining, that many young people are walking into employment at jobs that pay less than people had 15 or 20 years ago. So I don't think it's an anomaly, and this speaks to the shrinking of the middle class and the need to very seriously address that issue.
Terry in Louisville, Colorado. We have about a half a minute before we have to take a break, Terry.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that an aspect of the pharmaceutical business that most people don't know about is that the big players make their drugs in America up until almost the final product. And then they ship in bulk to the Caribbean, Costa Rica, Mexico.
Puerto Rico as well, yeah.
All just for the tax break that they get when they re-import the final product. We're putting Americans out of work so that the big pharmaceutical companies can make an extra bonus on tax time. This is ludicrous.
That's right. There were, because the caller is right, Terry is right, there have been special tax breaks worth billions given to the pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah, and because they're throwing money around in the halls of Congress.
They are huge in terms of their lobbying and campaign contributions, absolutely.
It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Senator-elect Bernie Sanders with us, the independent. 27 minutes past the hour, 866-440-THOM. Our telephone number, TomHartmann.com. If you want to visit our live chat room, we'll be right back.
On the fifth day of Bushmas, my president gave to me a stunt to the START treaty so we could be legal, building Star Wars 2 to defend our lack of a democracy. On the sixth day of Bushmas, my president gave to me stock market tips to replace Social Security. On the seventh day of Bushmas, my president gave to me faith-based initiatives to replace Social Security. On the eighth day of Bushmas, my president gave to me drills for the Arctic, water laced with arsenic, oil won't mix with water, but oil and government oughta in a centrifuge, which we'll set up in a wildlife refuge.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour.
My president.
No, not happy Bushmas. Merry Christmas. Happy weather. The next to the last day of Hanukkah. Blessed be. Boxing Day is coming up. We just passed winter solstice. Happy winter now is with us. Welcome back. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Bernie Sanders is with us, the independent senator from the state of Vermont in the United States Senate. Our number, 1-866-440-8466, TomHartmann.com. However you spell it, we'll get you there and drop by our live chat room. And just it's right up at the top of the page. Just click live chat if you want to get in there. Joe in Hobart, Indiana. Joe, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, it's an honor to talk to both of you. I listen to you every Friday. And my question is there any chance that they're going to do anything with the bankruptcy bill? Short story is my daughter, no insurance, had to have surgery and $300,000 in debt.
So you're talking about repealing the bankruptcy legislation? The recent
Well, Joe is referring, I suspect, to the very bad bankruptcy bill that was passed a couple of years ago that was essentially written by the banks and the credit card companies, which is going to make life a lot more difficult for many middle-income and working families. What I would say to Joe is that is one piece of legislation among many, including the prescription drug Medicare bill, many trade agreements, that I do hope the Congress will take a hard look at If people are forced into bankruptcy, we want to make sure that they get out of it as whole as they possibly can, and rather than just protecting credit card companies and banks. So it is a bill that we're going to want to look at.
John in Los Angeles, California, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Good morning. Nice talking to both of you. Actually, listening while I've been on hold, I've actually got two quick questions, and then I'll hang up and listen to your response. The first one is regarding these school loans that kids take to go to college. My son will be graduating in a year from high school, and we're really in a dilemma, wondering if the draft is reinstated and he's in college and he's got a loan. From what I understand is they'll finish out the semester and have to report. Now, the dilemma we have is, do I tell him just to enroll into the Navy or the Air Force, do his 4 years and then go to college, or how are they going to deal with that?
First of all, John, let me jump in. In my humble opinion, Congress is not going to be passing any draft legislation in the foreseeable future. I am opposed to it. I think the vast majority of the members of Congress are opposed to it. There are a few people who may be pushing it. They are in the strong minority.
Okay. And then the second question is, all these companies like Halliburton and stuff that are getting these awarded these bids, no contract bids, and they're funneling their funds through like the Cayman Islands and not paying any taxes. Is there going to be legislation or something to deal with this? Because of this?
Let me answer that, Joe. John, in two words, damn right.
Okay.
I mean, what you got here is two separate issues. Number one is that you have companies like Halliburton and other contractors who have gotten billions of dollars in no-bid contracts. The evidence is pretty overwhelming that they're ripping off the system, becoming immensely profitable, while at the same time our men and women in the armed forces, among other places, or in Louisiana, are not getting the services or the help that they need. So that has to be looked at. But the second part of it is that a number of large corporations are quite intentionally trying to avoid American taxes by moving to Bermuda, the Cayman Islands, or whatever, establishing a post office box and claiming they're a Cayman Island corporation. That is clearly an effort to evade American taxes, and I have introduced legislation on that in the House, and certainly we'll be working on that in the Senate.
Okay, very good. Armin and Braden's in Florida. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hey, Bernie and Tom, both of you, I respect you. I know you're very educated. And, Bernie, I know your heart's in the right place. But for God's sakes, will you please help stuff like people like my wife and me? Let me tell you why. We're a small business. The health insurance company screwed me. Now I got a pre-existing. They want to screw me for $20,000. A third of what we make goes to taxes. A third of what we make goes to expenses. We're lucky if we get a third. I don't have any health insurance. We can't afford it. It's outrageous at $20,000. We go to the mall. We go around Florida. You should come down here to Florida. There's a fair amount of people down here that's running around. They get free housing, free health care, free health insurance, Medicaid. They get everything that we don't get. We're paying for it. We live in a country that calls itself free. If me and my wife don't pay our taxes, we go to federal prison, but we have to be forced to support people that don't even have to work or pay in. What's fair about that? And I know you guys go on and on about education. Education's important, but in my opinion, if you don't give all your people the basic catastrophic health care as a social safety net, no matter how educated you are or how progressive you are, everything can be ripped out from underneath you like it did to us.
Okay, Armin, I got it. And the answer is, you've raised two issues. And the first issue that you've raised is that you are one of, I believe, 48 million Americans who have no health insurance at all. That number is going up every single day. The health care system is disintegrating. With all of the uninsurance, all of the uninsured and underinsured, we spend twice as much per person on health care as does any other major country. It is absurd. We are going to be working as hard as we can, Armin, for a national health care program which provides health care as a right for all people. That is a huge issue, not only from a human point of view. Nobody should be going without access to health care, but it is an economic issue as well. Many small businesses simply cannot afford these huge increases. Here in Vermont, we're talking to small businesses who are paying 20 or 30% more a year for health insurance. I just got off the elevator walking into my into the office here today. Guy's paying, what is he paying, $12,000 a year for himself and his wife. This is unsustainable. Unsustainable. So we have got to move toward a health care system, a national health care system, where health care is a right of all people. I will be working very hard on that.
Ian in San Francisco, California.
Hi, yeah. I just wanted to throw out an idea, you know, on how we might save some money in the health care system. You know, the most expensive part of the health care system, or at least one of the main expensive parts, is the end of life, where, you know, heroic measures and various things are done to help people continue to live and to live the best they can. We've got a large group of people in the country who are very convinced that they're going to heaven, and they may be. But what I would ask is that Bush, as part of his faith-based initiatives, ask each of them to sign advance directives that would indicate that no heroic measures will be taken in their case.
An ironic comment.
I won't comment on that.
Yeah, okay. Wilson in Fort Myers, Florida. Hey, Wilson, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Holy cow, I'm a star. I finally made it.
You're a star, Wilson.
And, Senator, listen, I'm just wondering. You're not dealing with Mensa material here, so please be patient with me. I'm wondering if it's possible that what happens with a whole lot of leaders all over the world when they don't get along with their military, like the way Bush has been ignoring them lately, what's the chances that they could really do something desperate? Is there any chance at all?
Well, no, I don't think we're looking at coups in the United States of America. But
absolutely out of the question. Huh?
Well, yes, I hope and think so. But you're raising a point that I don't know all if all the listeners kind of know what you're talking about. But what I assume you're talking about is you have a situation now where our president is talking about a surge of 20, 30, 40,000 new troops into the Baghdad area, while the Joint Chiefs of Staff appear to be pretty unanimous in thinking that's a dumb idea. I think what Congress has got to do is work with the Joint Chiefs of Staff, making that clear to the President, but more importantly, given the disastrous, underlying disastrous record of the Bush administration in Iraq, getting us into a war that we should not have gotten into, being totally unprepared as to what to expect, and now not knowing how to get us out while that country disintegrates into a horrible, horrible civil war. I think it's incumbent upon the Congress to say, thank you, Mr. President, you've screwed it up for a long time. We're going to be playing a much more active role on this issue.
Larry in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Larry, we have to take a break in about a half a minute.
Okay, hey, Bernie, with the record deficit and with around here in Michigan with a lot of people out of work and in need and stuff, can you please tell me, I just heard on the news that my Congress, Senator Stabenow, just got this huge bill passed to fund restoration of lighthouses. Is there no sanity? And I want to see money go to help people, not lighthouses, of which a lot of them are privately owned.
Well, without commenting on that bill, of which I know nothing, clearly we need to address the deficit through progressive, doing away with the tax breaks that Bush gave to his wealthy friends. But one of the ways we, in fact, create new jobs is through infrastructure improvement that includes affordable housing, rebuilding our roads, bridges, and schools.
Well said. 45 minutes past the hour. Bernie Sanders is with us, Senator-elect Bernie Sanders, a Vermont independent member of the United States Senate, going on 3 years here every Friday, answering questions on our program, 866-440-8466, 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. Place where despair is not an option. Get active, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 9.5 minutes before the hour. Senator-elect Bernie Sanders with us, our regular Friday noon Eastern time, noon to 1 Eastern time segment, our Brunch with Bernie program. Nina in St. Paul, Minnesota, St. Paul, Nebraska, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi, thank you for both for all that you do. I have a young friend who's serving in Iraq.
And he said he has told his mother that what the Army has lowered their budget, cut their budget, and what that's done is cut the meals. So if he's on guard duty, he doesn't get served a meal. So all he wants for Christmas is for us to send him food.
Well, I mean, you know, that's just incredible. We spend $500 billion a year on the military, and if we can't get food to the people who are in the midst of active duty in an incredibly dangerous environment, that just, you know, what can we say? I mean, this just, well, just touches on just all kinds of issues in terms of Iraq.
And what needs to be done about it.
Yeah, I mean...
Brian in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Good afternoon, Senator. Am I correct in thinking that, you know, U.S. jobs can stay here for manufacturing if we invest in equipment, new technologies, factories, as opposed to, you know, allowing jobs to go overseas?
Well, Brian, I think that's a little bit simplistic. I think we need to take a very hard look at our current trade policies, PNTR with China, NAFTA, Central American Free Trade Agreement, because ultimately, so long as you have legislation which allows American companies to throw workers in this country out on the street, move to China, pay people their 30 cents an hour, and bring their product back into this country, it's pretty hard to see why they won't do that. That's the reason behind why they fought for these trade agreements, and that's what's happening, and that's one of the reasons why poverty in America is going up, middle class is in decline, and the gap between the rich and the poor is growing wider. So I think, obviously, we want to figure out ways to get reinvestment into this country, but I think the key issue is our disastrous trade policies, in my view.
Jerry in Long Island, New York. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Yes, thanks very much for taking my call. And Senator-elect, it's my pleasure to be speaking with you. My question for you is with respect to the war in Iraq and Bush wanting to send in more troops. I'd like to know what you think of Democrats like Hillary Clinton and Democratic leaders like Harry Reid, what you think about them once again spinelessly going along with Bush instead of standing up to him and just saying no when Bush says and indicates he wants to escalate the war in Iraq by sending in more American troops into that country to die for his lies. And, you know, to me, I mean, first of all, clearly this is not what me and many other voters voted for on November 7th. This is not the progressive agenda change we voted for. And clearly 2007 has to be the new year for changing the course and direction in Iraq and withdrawing U.S. troops in Iraq and not increasing their numbers as Bush wants to do. And I'd like to know what you think of Democrats not doing enough to stand up to Bush and just saying no to
him. We got it. Okay, you raise a very important point. I think the idea of putting more troops into Iraq is totally absurd. I think we have had a surge. The surge has resulted in more chaos, more death in Iraq for Iraqis and for American troops. I think, as I have been saying for a long time, the time is now to begin bringing our troops home. And I think we should be able to get virtually all of them out of Iraq within the next year. So I certainly think that this idea of a surge is absurd. I think you're seeing the military leadership of our country saying that it is absurd, and I will do everything that I can in the United States Senate to oppose that policy.
Yeah, but you don't control the Democratic Party. You're not even a Democrat.
Right. You're going to find, I mean, you will find different points of view. And by the way, you will find different points of view on the Republican side as well.
Yeah.
You will find some Republicans who think that this is a very bad idea. Bush's idea of a surge. So we're going to fight as hard as we can to bring our troops home as safely as we can and as soon as we can.
Sam in Sacramento, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Good morning. Happy holidays, gentlemen. Two quick comments, Bernie. A piece of audio and video that is worth revisiting is Bush's, then-Governor Bush's comments in the debates with Al Gore about you only use your military when you absolutely have to, using overwhelming force and an exit strategy, which brings me to my second point. One of the bills you're going to be voting on is the new $100 billion that the Pentagon is asking for. And a piece of legislation that I would like to see come hand-in-hand with that is a military bill of rights, which would address exit strategy, number of deployments, backdoor deployments. how much we're going to spend on shop worn equipment and pulling our troops and support for the families and on and on.
Very good, Sam. I would agree with you, and I think that's a very good point. The budget is the mechanism by which, A, we protect our troops so long as they are in harm's way in Iraq, but secondly, it is the mechanism by which we bring them home as soon as we can. And I agree with what Sam said.
Yeah. So what do you think the probabilities are that something's going to happen?
Well, something will happen. I mean, lots of things.
Something like a Bill of Rights for the GIs.
Well, it's not just a Bill of Rights for GIs. I mean, that takes us to making sure that we protect our veterans and make sure that these guys get everything that they are entitled to.
Yeah.
You heard a caller a few minutes ago talk about soldiers in Iraq not getting enough food.
Right.
But Sam's main point is how do we use the budget process to bring our troops home? And he's absolutely right. That's something we've got to look at.
Great. Senator-elect Bernie Sanders, next time we talk, you will be Senator Bernie Sanders, right?
No, it'll be on the 4th is when we get to.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay. So we'll talk again next Friday. And
then it'll be a Senator-elect.
Yes, it'll be. Okay, we'll talk to you again next Friday, Bernie. Thanks so much for being with us.
Bye-bye.
Bernie Sanders. Oh, my. In the next hour, coming up, we're going to talk with Brian Fitzpatrick. He's a senior editor at the Media Research Center, one of these conservative groups who is convinced that there is a war on Christmas. Yeah.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, Hanukkah's wrapping up. The winter solstice is past. We are now past the Yule, the old pagan Yule season. Blessed be. And Christmas is upon us. Is there really a war on Christmas? Is the real spirit of Christmas under attack? Brian Fitzpatrick is a senior editor at the Media Research Center, mediaresearch.org, the website. Brian, welcome to the program.
Oh, Merry Christmas, Tom. How are you?
Thank you, Brian. Merry Christmas to you. I'm fine. I'm great. In fact, I'll get better. I would propose, Brian, that you and the conservatives who are aligned with you are waging the real war on Christmas. The North Pole is melting, and Santa Claus is going to drown.
Well, gosh, I'm not sure if I'm prepared to discuss global warming. Maybe I should send it to one of our other departments to handle
that. All right. Well, you're putting together a naughty and nice list here, and you do seem to be genuinely convinced that there are liberals out there, or actually the mainstream media, I guess, which you consider to be liberal. The mainstream media is waging a war on Christmas. I don't get it. I don't see it.
Well, have you turned on your TV recently?
Yeah.
Last night on the National Geographic Channel, there was a lengthy special, a couple of hours, about Jesus, and the focus was on the Gnostic Gospels. Are you familiar with the Gnostic Gospels?
I have read the Gnostic Gospels. I've read two of Elaine Pagel's books on the Gnostic Gospels and one of Peter Funk's books on them, and I wrote a book that in part is based on the Gospel of Thomas.
Well, that's wonderful. But then you should understand my point clearly enough that for the people out there who are Orthodox Christians, who actually believe in the original four Gospels, the presentation of the Gnostic Gospels just a few days before we celebrate Christ's birth might be taken as offensive.
Why?
Why?
First of all, I'm assuming by Orthodox you don't mean the Orthodox Church, which actually...
small O Orthodox.
Actually, would probably embrace the Gnostic Gospels. The Orthodox Church of Russia or Egypt, I mean, because they claim a lineage different than the Catholic Church. But no
Orthodox priest I know of would embrace the Gnostic Gospels. The Gnostic Gospels were a series of Gospels that were written about the life of Christ, and they were written by people in the 2nd and 3rd centuries, as opposed to the original Gospels, which were written in the 1st century by eyewitnesses.
Some say.
Well, I think that there's a very strong consensus in the academic community now that all of the New Testament documents were written between 45 AD and 90 AD.
Yeah, and the Quella document actually seems to be the key to that, and the Gospel of Thomas, of the Gnostic Gospel, seems to be the one that also ties back to that. But the point is, what does this have to do with any kind of war on Christmas? Are you saying that there are people out there who are trying to diminish people's belief in Christianity?
I think that's exactly the point. And why otherwise, at every Christmas and Easter, which are the two greatest holidays in the Christian year, do we see U.S. News and Newsweek this year, or the National Geographic Channel I just referred to, running lengthy cover stories that attack the fundamental beliefs of the Christian faith?
These are not attacks, these are examinations. And frankly, it seems to me that the real war on Christmas that's going on is that, you know, there's one place in the Bible where Jesus says, this is it. You know, his disciples come to him and say, how do we get into heaven? How do we get to hang out with you in heaven? And he says, you know, it's in 25th chapter of Matthew, I'm sure you're familiar with it. He says, you know, when I come back and I'm going to be sitting on the throne and I'm going to separate the sheep and the goats, and I was hungry and you gave me something to drink, and I was thirsty and you gave me something hungry, you gave me something to eat, and I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink, and I was a stranger and you invited me in, and I was naked and you clothed me, and I was sick and you visited me, and I was in prison and you visited me, and I was sick and you healed me. And his disciples were just baffled. They said, we've never seen you hungry. We're screwed. We're not going to get into heaven now. You know, what do we do? And he says, I tell you the truth, as you did to the least of these of my brothers, you did for me. And what I'm hearing on the right is no promotion at all of things like let's build programs in the United States to care for the 10 to 12 million Americans who are literally going to bed hungry every night. Nothing about the 44 million Americans who have no health insurance. Instead, I'm hearing conservative efforts to strip Social Security away from people. What I'm hearing is anti-Christian rhetoric constantly coming from your side of the aisle.
Have you ever visited a Salvation Army soup kitchen?
What does the Salvation Army have to do with the right wing?
The problem is that you're assuming that if right wingers care about problems with poverty, homelessness, social justice, that the response ought to be the same as the left-wing one, which is to support federal programs to address the problems. Many conservatives give their money to their churches, and their churches support organizations like the Salvation Army. Many conservatives
so you feel that as a society, through this collective institution that we created back in 1787, we the people.
The government does. Society is not defined by what the government.
If I could finish my sentence.
What the people do.
Brian, we the people is, that's the first three words of our Constitution. The government is us in the United States. I mean, maybe this is a headline for you, but we the people are the government is us. This is not the Soviet Union. We own our government. It doesn't own us.
Right.
And so if
we're not limited to the government. We do many things here on the conservative side of the aisle, which is not the same thing as the Christian side, by the way. But we do many things for the people in the country that have nothing to do with working through federal government programs.
But if we the people collectively get together and say, you know, there shouldn't be hunger among us. There shouldn't be poverty among us. There shouldn't be people who don't have access to medical care among us. And obviously, the conservatives who say that they're Christians and care about this are not putting up enough to take care of it, because we've got 10 million people who are going to bed hungry, 30 million people who have what Bush euphemistically refers to as food insecurity, 44 million people who have no access to health care, causing, according to conservative figures, according to Cato Institute figures, 18,000 Americans a year to die simply because of lack of health insurance, then we've got a problem that is not only, you talk about a war on Christmas, this is a war on Jesus Christ.
Well, I think that you're misstating a couple of points here, but just let me address one right now. You said that conservatives aren't giving enough. I would like to point out that conservatives are a great deal more generous with their income than liberals are.
Sir, as a Christian and a liberal, I am offended by that.
I
would submit to you that you have nothing to back that up.
I'm sorry that you're offended by facts, but you really ought to take a look at some of the studies that have come out recently about charitable giving. In fact, if you give me an email address, I'll certainly shoot some to you, because you ought to know it's quite embarrassing. It's received a lot of press coverage, actually, in the past 2 months about studies coming out that indicate that conservatives and religious believers are much more charitable givers than liberals and secular people.
And
higher percentage of their incomes go to charitable causes. So you shouldn't be accusing conservatives of not giving enough.
Of course, if you're going to separate secular people from people who go to church, you're going to find that people who go to church church and tithe, give more. I mean, you know, this is like, you know, it's like saying, gee, let's look at all the taxis in New York City that are not yellow. Oh, there's none. Or, you know, let's do a study that only includes yellow taxis. That's called sample bias. But the fact of the matter is that the progressive worldview, the liberal worldview, as it were, is you know, very fundamental. Franklin Roosevelt laid it out.
I see one third of a nation ill housed, ill clad, ill nourished.
And he did something about it. And you guys have been trying to undo it for 60 years.
Well, all I can tell you is
that's the war on Christmas.
Mental perception differences about what's best for people and what's best for society. And we're going to have to accept this and not accuse each other of ill will, just but, because we have different views about what's the best way
I agree with you on that. And if you believe that I have personally accused you of ill will, Brian.
Oh, no, I don't think you've accused me of anything at all. And so no sweat about that. Okay. Besides, it's the Christmas season, and I'm particularly charitable nowadays.
Okay. Well, I think we should be particularly charitable all the time. I think that was the great commission that was given to us. That's the work. And yet, on the other side, we've got this.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
And so, again, I ask you, Brian Fitzpatrick, senior editor for the Media Research Center, mediaresearch.org, this war on Christmas, if we collectively, if we the people collectively decide that we're going to do something about poverty in the United States, what's wrong with that?
Oh, I think it's a wonderful thing to do something about poverty in the United States. And there are many people on the conservative side and many religious believers of a great variety of faiths who are doing things that really help people.
No, if we decide to do it to our government.
My point is that there are other institutions besides government that address these problems, and there's a great deal of
information
out there that indicates that government actually exacerbates problems rather than helping them.
Lyndon Johnson cut poverty in half in the United States. Before Franklin Roosevelt started Social Security, the leading cause of death in the winter months among people over 60 years of age was hypothermia. He solved that problem with Social Security. The government has solved problems, sir.
Oh, I would agree that Social Security has greatly diminished poverty amongst the elderly in the United States. There's no question about it. On the other hand, it's also beginning to bankrupt the country. So Brian, we have to look at costs and benefits.
Okay, we'll have to leave it at that. Brian Fitzpatrick, you get the last word. Brian Fitzpatrick, he's the senior editor for the Media Research Center, mediaresearch.org, the website. It's the season. We'll be back. Merry Christmas, Brian. Thanks for being with us. 16 past the hour. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. By the way, on January 5th, I'll be in Pittsburgh doing my show live at WPTT and doing a book signing at Borders in Monroeville. On January 6th, we'll be in Minneapolis doing a book signing for Screw, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class, What We Can Do About It, at Magers and Quinn at 2 o'clock. And it goes on from there. You can get the schedule over at our website, tomhartman.com. Amazon offering an additional 5% off on Screwed right now. And just speaking of books, I am writing a book on the air right now. We had 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, we had Johanna on, my editor, who basically interviewed me for an hour for the introduction to the book. You know, what's the book about? What are you going to do? It's titled Cracking the Code, The Art and Science of Political Persuasion. And the third hour of our program today, we're going to be talking about that. But it is the anniversary of the birth of the Prince of Peace. Christmas. And so I thought appropriate that we think about peace, that we hear some previous leaders of the United States speak about peace. This is John Kennedy.
I have therefore chosen this time and place to discuss a topic on which ignorance too often abounds and the truth too rarely perceived, and that is the most important topic on earth, peace.
And he continues.
What kind of a peace do I mean, and what kind of a peace do we seek? Not a Pax Americana, enforced on the world, by American weapons of war, not the peace of the grave.
Yeah, tell that to George W. Bush. I'm going to try and minimize my interruptions of this, but occasionally...
Or the security of the slave. I am talking about genuine peace, the kind of peace that makes life on earth worth living, the kind that enables men and nations to grow and to hope and build a better life for their children. Not merely peace for Americans, but peace for all men and women. Not merely peace in our time, but peace in all time.
But peace in all time.
I speak of peace, therefore, as the necessary rational end of rational men. I realize the pursuit of peace is not as dramatic as the pursuit of war, and frequently the words of the pursuers fall on deaf ears, but we have no more urgent task.
And he was so right. We really have no more urgent task. And we just have to stand down these guys who think that war and killing is the way to solve all problems.
No government or social system is so evil that its people must be considered as lacking in virtue.
And yet we've killed 600,000 Iraqis.
Our military forces are committed to peace and disciplined in self-restraint. Our diplomats are instructed to avoid unnecessary irritants and purely rhetorical hostility.
Until John Bolton came along.
For we can seek a relaxation of tensions without relaxing our guard. And for our part, we do not need to use threats to prove we are resolute.
No, and in fact, Kennedy even believed we should use the United Nations for peace.
Meanwhile, we seek to strengthen the United Nations to help solve its financial problems, to make it a more effective instrument for peace, to develop it into a genuine world security system, a system capable of resolving disputes on the basis of law, of ensuring the security of the large and the small, and of creating conditions under which arms can finally be abolished.
The season of peace. John Kennedy speaking about peace.
The United States, as the world knows, will never start a war.
Boy, doesn't it make you want to weep when you hear that?
We do not want a war. We do not now expect a war. This generation of Americans has already had enough, more than enough, of war and hate and oppression.
There was a time when that was actually an applause line. Now you'd be labeled a commie pinko peacenik.
We shall be prepared if others wish it. We shall be alert to try to stop it. But we shall also do our part to build a world of peace where the weak are safe and the strong are just. We are not helpless before that task or hopeless of its success. Confident and unafraid, we must labor on, not towards a strategy of annihilation, but towards a strategy of peace.
This is really, I just have to say, this is where we should be. This is the vision we should be holding. This is the place we should be going whenever we're going to discuss Christmas, frankly, 365 days out of the year. This is a fundamental issue. Can we live peacefully with each other and with the rest of the planet, with all life on Earth? Because if we don't resolve that fundamental issue, we're toast. And I frankly believe that we can. It's just a matter of choosing good representatives and getting politically engaged ourselves. 27 minutes past the hour.
Burning up the atmosphere and cutting down the trees. The billion-dollar bombing of a nation on his knees. Anyone not marching to their tune, they call it treason. Everyone says God is on his side. See the lightning, hear the cries of the wounded in a world in holy war. Thunder from the sky, killing every everything they say they're fighting for.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, the place where reason is our lifestyle choice. This just in from the wire services. In a dramatic turnabout from its previous harsh condemnation, the Christian Coalition has decided to embrace Dick Cheney's pregnant lesbian daughter, claiming that she's actually the second coming of the Virgin Mary. Reached at his offices at Liberty University, the Reverend Jerry Falwell conceded that the Christian right had been short-sighted in trying to boot this Mary out of the manger when she actually offered a tremendous upside to the evangelical cause. Let's face it, Falwell stated, she is a Mary. She's probably technically a virgin, and it really wouldn't surprise me if her life partner is a carpenter. The Reverend Pat Robertson also bestowed his Virgin Mary blessing on Cheney's daughter, whose lesbianism some trace to her utter disgust with Dick. Robertson asserted that the return of the Savior through the Cheney bloodlines was not really a surprise, given the vice president's policy of bringing Armageddon to the Middle East. Now, it's actually from satiricalpolitical.com, but it's what can I say? Merry Christmas. Welcome back. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number, 866-440-8466. Gene in Napa, California. Hey, Gene, welcome to the program.
Hi there, Tom. I so appreciated your comeback to your guest about the war on Christmas, or as I call it, the war on religious freedom.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
Yeah, the figures on charitable giving are skewed, as you pointed out. What is classified as charity today? Donations used to build coffee shops and conduct church camps for indoctrination?
Yeah, or for that matter, if a bunch of us get together and say, you know, we want to make sure that we all have a national health care program and we're all going to raise our own taxes to pay for it, is that a contribution? I mean, I would say so. If we're talking about solving social ills, you're right.
I live in an agricultural area. They use a lot of transient farm workers, and there's always a housing problem here, and it's terrible poverty. They have no place to sleep or stay that's healthful. The growers don't want to supply these. Churches can come forward and try to supply some for that, but they can never do it all.
Yeah.
And they can never do it all. Only the growers know how many people they're going to use and everything. Why should the churches be expected to pick that up anyway? It's an economic problem.
Right. Charity for a church or for people in a church or a synagogue or a mosque or whatever it may be, charity is something that you do because it's what you do. It's you do it not just to feel good and not just to attain salvation or to get to heaven or something. It's something that you do because it's, well, I suppose probably everybody has their own personal motivation. You know, speaking just for myself, it's what you do because that's the price of being human. That's
human decency.
Exactly. It's just it's the baseline of human life is to be here for each other and to help each other out. But when we're looking at government, we're looking at we coming together, we collectively, we the people, the first three words of the Constitution, as a community, and deciding what are the standards of life in our community that we have the ability to define and are therefore going to use the force of law to define. And you're absolutely right. We shouldn't be abdicating that responsibility and just saying, oh, well, let's just let the churches deal with it. Gene, thank you for the call. Good to hear from you. James in New Paltz, New York. Hey, James, what's up?
Tom, thank you. Merry Christmas.
Well, thank you. Merry Christmas to you, too.
Just a comment. I flip to the channels every so often to listen to what the other side is doing, and I've noticed that your ideas about the middle class being screwed or being co-opted by other people to push ideas that have nothing to do with you. I'm talking specifically about this one person, I think his name is Glenn Beck, and he's picking up the mantra of the middle class being screwed, but he's talking, using it as a way to bash immigrants.
Oh, jeez.
And I thought it was really disturbing, because I think he's from your home state of Michigan, if I'm not mistaken. I hope you've heard of this man.
Yeah, Glenn Beck, you know, has been in radio for not as many years as I have, but, yeah, James, thanks for the heads up, but I think I'm just going to take a pass on commenting about it. I appreciate it, though. Todd in Marina, California. Hey, Todd, what's up?
Hey, happy holidays.
Yeah.
You know, I was listening to your guest. Listening to your guest, and, you know, he is the type of person that talks as an expert, but I don't think he's ever utilized government programs or church programs for poverty. Because the government, you know, the first two things come to mind are food stamps and WIC. Now, with food stamps, you can go to the store, and if you properly purchase products, you can eat healthy. WIC, you know, gives fresh dairy products, you know, fresh fruit, baby formula. The churches, which are trying to do a very good job, they rely on donations from usually the local businesses. And unfortunately, I've utilized these programs before, and what you get is stuff that they can't sell or stuff that is like the day before it's being expired. And 90% of it is not healthy. You know, you get a box of macaroni and cheese, you get, you know, peanut butter, you get pasta, which when you're hungry, that is very good. But it's, you know, there's health issues that go along with it.
Well, that's the point. I mean, charity from churches should say that we're going to solve the problems caused by laissez-faire economics, the problems caused by conservative economic policies that wipe out the middle class and drive up the level of the working poor and poverty in the United States by saying, oh, let's just turn it over to the churches, is crazy. First of all, we need the structural problem. I mean, the best welfare program that there is in the world is a good-paying job,
right?
Period. End of discussion.
Right.
I mean, that's where the rubber meets the road. And that's what Franklin Roosevelt did in 1935 with the Wagner Act. And it's what the Republicans started to systematically undo in 1947 when they passed Taft-Hartley, a piece of legislation that allowed individual states to opt out of the Wagner Act and have the so-called right-to-work states. And they've been chipping away at the Wagner Act ever since. And I think, you know, Taft-Hartley should be repealed. And we should, and you know, Teddy Roosevelt back in 1913 talking about a living wage. He's the guy who invented the phrase. And a living wage should be enough, he said, for someone to retire on, to save for the retirement, to take a vacation, to raise their children and pay for their education all the way through higher education, to pay all of their medical expenses of their family, and to own the home that they live in. I mean, that was the definition in 1913 by a Republican president of what a living wage should be. How far out of touch with that have we gone? And that's the problem in the United States right now, is that we've allowed this so-called conservative thinking. Well, it is conservative thinking. We've allowed this conservative thinking that submits and suggests that all problems are solved by a so-called free market. There is no such thing as a free market. And big multinational corporations, that should be the solution to all problems. And by the way, we need an aristocracy in this country, a meritocracy. So the wealthiest among us, let's just look to them for our problems. So if Bill and Melinda Gates will solve all our problems, wouldn't that be wonderful? And God bless them. They're doing a lot of good work. But that's not how society should be organized, to say, well, we hope that some of the rich folks among us are going to help us out. No, it's not how it works. We need to create a society where we don't have hunger, we don't have starvation, we don't have poverty. People who want to work can work, and when they do work, they can actually raise a family based on it. Jacob in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Jacob.
Hello.
Hey.
As a secular humanist and an atheist, pretty much, I would like to make it clear that the holiday spirit is very strong with the majority of us. And I think that Brian, the previous guest, what was his last name?
Brian Fitzpatrick of the Media Research Center.
Yeah. Now, he, like, lost that. And how do those of you that ascribe to the same religion that he claims to belong to, how do you correct that in small ways?
Well, the point that I make whenever I hear somebody like him, and I don't want to speak specifically of Brian because he's not here to defend himself, and I really don't like to trash guests when they're not around to defend themselves.
Sure.
But when I hear people say, Christians believe, or this is what Christianity means, As he mentioned something about that, you know, and I said, I'm sorry, as a Christian, I'm offended by that. It's you're just not going to go there with me. I'm sorry. There's not one little sect of Christianity that gets to define what Christianity means any more than Osama bin Laden gets to define what Islam means.
Well, and it's sort of like Virgil Good's quote, you know, when he's attacking the Muslim Ellison.
Yeah.
And so what do you do with that? I mean,
well, what you do is you expose it. I mean, that's the bottom line. I'm assuming that you're talking.
But do you think there are too many Middle Easterners in the United States right now?
I'm not going to say yes or no on that. I'd like to know the exact number. I don't have the exact numbers. I know.
I'm not even going to play the whole clip.
That's Virgil Good.
I mean, he's just nuts.
Yeah, and then folks like Gordon Smith and Orrin Hatch too. Cool.
Well, I haven't heard Gordon Smith or Orrin Hatch make comments like that, but Virgil Good has clearly gone off the rails there. Jennifer in Sacramento. Hey, Jennifer.
Hi, Tom. I was also calling about that Brian Fitzpatrick guest that you had on. It bothered me that he claimed, basically, that the conservatives and the Christians are one and the same. And I'm a Christian, and I'm a flaming liberal. And I would like to see the proof that he's ready to provide showing that conservatives give more money to charity or give more to charity than liberals.
Yeah.
That was offensive to me as well.
The extent to which that evidence is out there, as I said, it's riddled with sample bias. It is these are ridiculous statistics that these guys are using, you know, just fundamentally. Jennifer, thank you for the call, and thank you for your kind comments. 45 minutes past the hour of the Tom Harbin radio program, and filling in this week also for Al Franken, and next week as well. Where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. We'll be right back.
Chipmunks roasting on an open fire. Hot sauce dripping from their toes.
Chipmunks?
Yuletide squirrels, fresh filleted by the choir.
Yuletide squirrels?
Hot skewers through their nose.
Hot damn! Wrong talk show host. I'm the vegetarian talk show host.
Help to make the season right. Tiny rats with a crisp golden coat will really hit the spot tonight.
All right, enough of that. Welcome back. 51 minutes past the hour. Tom Harbin here with you. 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number. Jeffrey in East Hampton, Massachusetts. Hey, Jeffrey.
Hi, Tom.
Yeah.
How are you doing?
Good. What's up?
I wanted to talk about the last guest you have. Brian Fitzpatrick.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't believe the last thing that he said.
Oh, Social Security is bankrupting us. No, it's not. You know, all we have to do is lift the cap on Social Security so Bill Gates pays the same percentage of his income as I do, and it will make the problem, the program solvent for you know, all the whole rest of human history.
Right, and I mean, it just, he, to say that he's a well-intentioned person and to make a comment like that, it's like he must know other things that are bankrupting.
Well, you know, I'm willing to cut him some slack and assume that he's actually believing the right wing hype that's coming out of the banking industry that's pushing so hard for this. I mean, these guys, there are a lot of people on the right who I think are victims of others on the right, and they listen to each other's nonsense and get each other all worked up, and it's frankly tragic, but it happens a lot. Jeffrey, thank you for the call. Victoria Jones is with us with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com, their website. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom. Well, I have to tell you, I mean, this is no news. I mean, it's
a quiet day in Washington.
It is so ridiculous in this town.
Yeah. By the way, I forgot to mention to Bernie Sanders, I'm going to be doing a radio row with you guys the last week of January, the week of inauguration, or the, it's the inauguration. It's the State of the Union speech, isn't it?
Oh, good.
Yeah, it's not the inauguration. It's the State of the Union. That's on Tuesday. I'll be actually showing up Thursday and Friday. I'll be doing the radio row from, what's the conference?
I don't know the title of
American Healthy Families Conference
something like that. Yeah.
In large part in response to the State of the Union. And then in March, I'm going to be doing a radio row that a right-wing conservative group is setting up.
Yes.
And they've got Dick Cheney and Condoleezza Rice and Ann Coulter. And
you're going to get them all?
That's what they tell me. Yeah, honest to goodness. We said, you know, I'd like to set up a booth there and, you know, be sitting there next to Sean Hannity and interviewing all these guys, all these right-wing cranks. But by the way, I'm syndicated on Air America Radio and I'm a liberal. And they're like, that's fine. That's fine. No problem. You know,
wow.
Pay your money, take your chances.
That would be a coup.
So, yeah, well, you know, I think one of the best shows I ever did was, I think you guys actually organized that radio row, was the one from the Republican National Convention.
Yes.
The RNC convention there where Terry Holt, the manager of Bush's campaign, sits down and three or four sentences into our conversation, he's all friendly and all this, and I start asking him really hard questions, and all of a sudden he goes, wait a minute, you're a liberal. I said, yes. And he goes, I'm not going to take this. And he pulls the headphones off and jumps up and stalks off. live and on the air. Because everybody, I was it. I mean, you know, there was everybody else there was some right-wing crank. Well, actually, Air America was there, but they had a big banner over the top that said Air America, you know. And
stealth one.
Yeah, it was a hoot. It was that was so much fun. So anyway, not much going on in Washington D.C. today.
Well,
so.
President's visiting Walter Reed and doing some of that kind of stuff, and then later on he'll be heading out to Camp David, and he'll spend Christmas in Camp David, and then he'll head off down to Crawford. Now, presumably, it's not going to be all vacation for the president. Don't forget, we're always told that, you know, that he continues to work when he's on vacation.
Yes, of course.
Probably about as hard as he works when he's, you know, here.
Yes, 56 warnings that Osama was going to strike us, and he ignored them all. He works real hard, this guy.
Well, that's where he's going to be next week, so let's hope that Osama's not thinking of pulling anything off, because he'll be there. But what he is supposedly going to be doing, we've got Secretary of Defense Robert Gates coming back, and he'll be making his recommendations from his trip to Iraq, from what he's seen.
Now it's being reported in the press that Gates was prepped for his testimony before Congress by Dick Cheney's office.
Yes.
Is that something that we should have expected, or something we should be horrified by? Is it right or is it wrong?
I think it's probably right. I think we should be horrified in a minor kind of way, if we can still be horrified by anything.
It sort of helps make things put things in perspective. You know, he knew he was. He said all the right things for the members of Congress, but if he'd been prepped by Dick Cheney's office, basically then that means that they sent him in and said, you say whatever you have to say, you know, obviously like they did with Alito and Roberts, say whatever you have to say to get Congress to rubber stamp you, and then we'll just go ahead and be right-wing cranks.
Well, it'll be interesting to see if that is what he's going to be, because at this point we still don't have a sense of that. We know that stylistically he's different from Rumsfeld. Well, I mean, you know.
But this is a guy who is part of Iran-Contra. I mean, this is a guy who's been around the block three or four times with these guys.
Right.
I'm sorry. I'm not willing to cut him the slack that everybody else seems to want to.
Well, you have a longer memory than most, and for some reason everybody has decided to forget the past with him.
Yeah. Well, and apparently there's been a full court press, even by, you know, ex-CIA agents, to go out and try and clean up Gates's CV, and I'm just not buying it. I'm not buying it at all. But time will tell. Maybe I'm wrong. I hope I'm wrong. I like to think the best of people, but we'll see. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. 56 minutes past the hour. Right after the news, the top of the hour, and the next hour, we're going to be talking about how people are motivated, how we motivate ourselves, how we motivate others. On air, live, I'm going to be writing the next chapter of my book, which will be coming out in the fall of 2007, Cracking the Code, The Art and Science of Political Persuasion. Stick around.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
So how do we effectively communicate a political message? How do you change somebody's mind politically? How do you transform them? How do you awaken them? Welcome back to the program, by the way. 6 minutes past the hour, the third hour of our program. And it's the last hour of our, the third hour of our Friday program. And what we started doing 2 weeks ago, I believe, maybe 3 weeks ago, is, and we're going to continue doing for probably another month and a half or so, is take this last hour of Friday each week and live and online, and we put transcripts of this up over at TomHartman.com on our message board. I'm going to be writing a book on the air. The title of the book is Cracking the Code, The Art and Science of Political Persuasion. It's based on my background and training in the advertising and marketing business and in the psychology field, or psychotherapy field, to be super precise. I was on the Vermont roster of psychotherapists. And neurolinguistic programming, NLP. I'm a licensed and certified NLP trainer, practitioner, and trainer. Richard Bandler, in fact, the founder of NLP, wrote the introduction to one of my books on this topic. So, anyhow, this book will be coming out in the fall of 2007, the fall of next year. We're literally writing it right now. And today's chapter is on motivation. How do we motivate ourselves? How do we motivate other people? What are the basic human motivation systems that are at work, and how do they work? Because if we understand how motivation happens to ourselves and others, then two extraordinary things open up to us. The first is that we can change our own internal motivation systems and decision-making strategies to move ourselves in directions that we want to move. And secondly, we have a better handle on, a better view of, a better story for how to help other people at least understand clearly what it is we're suggesting in a political context so that they can decide whether or not to be motivated by it. And also, I suppose number three is a bonus. If you let people know how motivation strategies work, then when those motivation strategies are being intentionally but surreptitiously inflicted upon them, they can spot them coming and say, oh no. In other words, it provides you with a sense, defense system. There are two foundational motivation strategies that we share as basically as mammals. But because we have conceptual and we have conceptual abilities and the ability to imagine and the ability to understand time and project into the future and remember the past and place it all in the context of time, which seems to place us relatively unique among most animals. There are some of the higher apes and there's some question about dolphins and some other mammals. It's becoming increasingly clear that they also have a sense of self and an understanding of time, but ours is quite well developed, and as a consequence of that, we have motivation strategies that go beyond just the purely animal responsive, you know, biological. In other words, they go from biological to psychological, but they're all founded in the biological. And there's these two polar opposites that are at the root of it, that are at the basis of it. And that is that we are almost at all times doing one of two things. We are at all times, virtually at all times, we are either moving away from pain or we are moving toward pleasure. Those are the two foundational motivation systems. Now, there's a real significant difference between these two. The biological imperative of them, by the way, moving away from pain. Put your hand in a fire, you're going to pull it back really quick. Pain produces a loud, hot, shouting, red, bright, whatever, you know, sensation experience in the nervous system that says, stop now! Right? That pain does that. Pleasure is typically nowhere near as extreme as pain. Even a small amount of pain, like just pricking your finger with a pin, for example, it's hard to produce a pleasure, an experience of pleasure that has that strong and that brief, that instantaneous an experience. It's really difficult. It's really rare. And I suppose you could argue that probably the closest we get to that are either drug-induced experiences. We've seen these things with rats where they'll push the bar to get the cocaine until they starve to death, that kind of thing, which is why some of these substances are so destructive. Or orgasm. And look at how many people have ruined their lives around sexuality, you know, around over-engaging, shall we say, in that. And so, but broadly, the vast majority of all of our other moving toward pleasure behaviors, setting aside drug-induced and sexual ones, are very, very, very gentle. Thinking about getting a pay raise or thinking about having a nice conversation with somebody or thinking about a nice lunch that we're going to have or even eating a good meal. None of that in terms of the intensity of the sensation comes even close to having somebody poke your butt with a pin. You go, whoa! You jump immediately. Man, I'm not going to jump for a meal. So it's useful, first of all, to understand the really, truly profound difference between these two experiences of moving away from pain and moving toward pleasure. Moving away from pain, and then to put it in a political context, which we'll be doing as we continue through this hour. Moving away from pain, to compare it with the force of nature, is like lightning. It's like the electromagnetic force. You know, in nature, there's these four forces. There's the electromagnetic force, the nuclear force, gravity, and the weak nuclear force, as I recall. It's been a long time since I took physics, but let's just take two of those, the electromagnetic force, lightning, for example, electricity, and gravity, a strong force and a weak force. If moving away from pain is like a bolt of lightning, then moving toward pleasure is like gravity. It's gentle, it's persistent, it's continuous, and over time it's irresistible. It's damn hard to defy gravity. And when you do, you can't do it for very long. So for long-term strategies of motivation, if we want to motivate people over the long term, if we want to get them involved in something over a long term, or if we want to motivate ourselves over the long term, if we want to wake up every day looking forward to the day and go to sleep every night looking forward to the next day, then we need to instill in ourselves, we need to build into ourselves long-term positive motivational strategies. On the other hand, if we need to, get an abrupt response from somebody, a sudden, stop type of response, then you use a moving away from pain strategy. Moving away from pain, you know, poking somebody with a sharp stick or the emotional equivalent. Moving away from pain strategies are very, 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 very powerful because this is, the sensation is so close to our nervous system. I mean, it's just bang, right into the nervous system, the whole moving away from pain thing. So if you can, if you're frightened by something, move away from pain. The problem with using moving away from pain strategies, even though we realize that they are very, very powerful and they get instant results, the problem with using moving away from pain strategies is that they wear out very quickly. It's sort of like, you know, whipping a horse. You can whip that horse and make it go faster and whip it and whip it and it goes faster and faster and whip it and faster until finally it falls over dead. And the same thing happens to all of us. I mean, so, for example, in management, you know, I mean, the biggest mistake that most managers make is that they manage based on moving away from pain. They criticize their employees. They catch people doing things wrong. They think that that's what management is. Management, you know, it's like parenting a one-year-old. You know, typically a child's first word is no, because there's been a lot of this moving away from pain stuff, because there's a lot of potential pain out there in the world. No, don't run out in the traffic. And so managers think their job is to catch people doing things wrong. A good manager understands that their job is to catch people doing things right. Because if you catch people doing things right, they'll want to do more of it. And they'll grow and they'll get better and better and better. So how do we politically do that, do the equivalent of that? How can we establish a political, positive, moving toward pleasure strategy? And what are the times in a political context when it's actually useful to use a moving away from pain strategy to put it out there, to throw it out there into the political arena? And what will the response be to it? And how long can you use it and when do you have to stop? We'll cover those things right after the break. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
Now, more of the Al Franken Show with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
This is the land of the free and the home of the brave. But George Bush doesn't think that way. He'd rather leave with everyone afraid than handle things the American way. But fear didn't make America great. Fear didn't make America great. Fear didn't make America great. Fear didn't make America great.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
People
stumpers, beepers, stumpers.
Indeed, welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. No, fear did not make America great. Back in 1978, from 78 to 83, I was the executive director, and I've been on the board of directors ever since, of the New England Salem Children's Village, which is a community residential treatment facility for severely abused and emotionally disturbed kids in New Hampshire. And then about 10 years ago, we started a school for attention deficit disorder kids, ADHD kids. They're also Hunter School. And SalemChildren'sVillage.org and HunterSchool.org on the web. And the majority, I would say, frankly, I would say all of the kids that we did intake on back then when I ran that program were the victims of severe abuse, but they were also the victims of parents who believed, who really only had one tool. They only had one motivation strategy. They only had one way to accomplish what they wanted to accomplish, and that was using moving away from pain. It was the only strategy that they understood, and so they would inflict pain. And I'm going to come back to the story in just a second, but let me just toss a call out here, first of all. If you have a real easy time waking up in the morning, if you're one of those people who wakes up even seconds before the alarm clock goes off, and you're out of bed, and you're just looking forward to the day, and you just have an easy, easy, easy time getting out of bed in the morning, and I'd just like to ask you a question about that experience. I think you'll find it interesting. Give us a call at 866-440-8466. And alternatively, if you have a really hard time getting out of bed, I mean really difficult, you have to hit the snooze button three or four times to get, and even then it's dragging out, it's really rough. Now, not as a consequence of biological things like you don't have enough sleep, you know, or you're working too many hours, but just, you know, it's there. That's how it is. Give me a call, and I'd like to put somebody on the air who has a really easy time getting out of bed and somebody who has a really hard time getting out of bed, and just share the contrasting internal motivation strategies to illustrate the point that I'm making here. Anyhow, back to the... And so in just a second, after Lauren has gone through and kind of filtered these out, we'll just pop a couple people on the air. Back to the kids. It's like, you know, the parents would yell at them when they were very young. And that didn't, you know, and that worked for a little while. But then it stopped working, and so then they, you know, hit them, and that worked for a little while, and then that stopped working. And then they hit them harder, and that worked for a little while, and that stopped working. And then they started hitting them with things. And it would escalate to the point, you know, one of the first kids that we did intake on, a little boy named Tony, he was 8 or 9 years old, his brother had been starved to death by his parents in the basement. I mean, he literally died. That's how Tony came to the attention of the people at the Department of Health and, or DCYF, whatever that, I've forgotten, Department of Family and Youth and Children or whatever it is. And his parents, I mean, you know, when they were asked about this, believed that they were trying to teach their kids how to be good citizens, that they were trying to teach their kids how to, you know, I mean, it's twisted and weird, but I can tell you, virtually every parent, severely abusive parents that I've ever talked to, and we had to interact with these folks as, you know, in running a program that cared for and provided therapy to their kids, they lacked the tool set. It's one of the reasons why I think it's so important that we'd be out there offering, you know, these toolkits in the context of parenting. Well, we're seeing the same thing, frankly, I think, in the context of country running. Louise makes the point that torture is moving away from pain. And, you know, so, of course, you're going to get some kind of response. It may not be an accurate response. You know, if I poke somebody with a pin, I'm going to get a response. I don't know that they're actually going to move 20 seconds to the right or 20 seconds, 20 degrees to the left. I know I'm going to get a response. So torture will produce a response. It may not be an accurate response. But what you really want to do, what a really competent interrogator does, knows how to do well, and does for a living, what a really brilliant interrogator does, what the FBI and what counterterrorism and interrogation folks in the NSA and the CIA, what they're really trained at doing is inducing the Stockholm Syndrome in people, causing people to identify with their captors. You know, what happened to Patty, what's her name, the young world woman who was with the Sudanese Liberation Army, Patty Hearst. And all of a sudden she's showing up in a bank with a machine gun. What? They took her captive. And then she started identifying with them. If you can induce the Stockholm Syndrome, if you can get somebody on your side, how do you do that? You have to do that with a positive moving toward pleasure strategy. So there's a profound difference. And we'll just give you an example of this real quickly with a couple of quick phone calls when we come back from the break. And then I'll explain how we can then take this knowledge into the political world. Our number 866-440-8466, although it appears that we have our callers on the line. TomHartmann.com, by the way, if you want to drop into our live chat room, say hi. 27 minutes past the hour.
Lights are coming on.
Back. The pill that will help you escape the matrix. Tom Hartmann here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. Julian, I'm going to put one caller on the left side of the board and one on the right side, just as a heads up for you. We have Loretta in Brooklyn, New York, and Pete in Madison, Wisconsin. And Loretta, you have an easy time getting up in the morning?
Oh, I most certainly do.
Okay, great. And Pete, you have a hard time getting up in the morning?
Absolutely.
Okay, great. I have a question for both of you. Let me just start with you, Loretta. Loretta, when you first wake up in the morning, what is the first thing that you typically think of that you're willing to talk about on the radio?
Turning on the computer.
Okay. And are you looking forward to that?
Yes, I do.
Okay, and when you look forward, when you imagine your day, the things that you're going to do throughout your day, broadly, what are you thinking of when you get up in the morning?
Excuse me?
The other things of your day that you're thinking about,
I already have my day planned out by the day before.
Ah, okay. And do you have it planned out based on the things you're looking forward to doing or the things that you're trying to avoid doing?
No, I look forward to everything I do.
Okay.
I'm an extremist. I'm very
You're an optimist.
Neat.
Yeah.
I'm a neat freak.
Okay. Loretta, hang on just a second here. Pete, when you wake up in the morning, what's the first thing that comes into your mind?
Well, sometimes it's, oh, God, I'm awake. But most of the time, it's kind of wondering what's going on in the world, in the news that day.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
And what is it that, you know, on a typical day or this morning, if you can remember, what is it that you might have thought about, you know, gee, I wonder what's going on in the news or like that? By the way, is that what motivates you to turn the radio on or listen to it?
Pretty much, yeah.
The curiosity?
Yeah, absolutely, especially okay. To, you know, your show. Actually, your show is pretty positive, so, but yeah, that's pretty much what motivates me is what's going on in the news, and even though I don't like a lot of what's going on and there's the moving away from pain, I want to be involved, so it's almost an approach avoidance conflict
yeah.
Type thing in a way.
Yeah, it sounds like you're actually sort of in the middle area. I had a person, I used to teach this in workshops and on marketing, advertising, communications, and I had a person, and also in psychology workshops actually, and a person once in one classroom I asked, you know, who had a really hard time. This guy had three alarm clocks by his bed, and he had to go because each one had only three opportunities on the snooze button before it gave up.
Mm-hmm.
And so he'd go through nine snooze buttons before he finally got up. And I asked him, you know, what is it that you imagine when you wake up? And he said, I think about going into work. And then I said, well, what do you think about going into work? And he says, well, I imagine myself showing up late. And that's how I get myself out of bed. And I said, well, and then what do you imagine? And he says, and then I imagine myself, you know, being yelled at by my boss. And I said, what's after that? And he said, well, and then my boss fires me finally because he's, you know, I've been late too many times. And then I imagine myself standing in the unemployment line and being humiliated by, you know, by standing there. And then I imagine the unemployment running out and
wow.
I'm being kicked out of my apartment. And as I'm being kicked out of my apartment, I'm living under a bridge with all my stuff in a shopping cart and some guy beats me up. And that was literally the movie this guy ran in his mind every morning in order to force himself out of bed. And as we deconstructed it, we learned that over time, over a period of years, he had gone from a relatively short negative moving away from pain strategy of just, you know, oh my God, I'm going to be late for work if I don't get out of bed, all the way through this whole thing about I'm going to end up dying and homeless and being beat up and rolled by people, you know, because I'm living on the streets, because he had to keep amping up the pain for it to work. And I'm curious, Pete, if you have any parallel experience. You don't need to give us any details on it, but is there any resonance there for you?
Not quite to the extent that he went to with it, but there is a resonance with regard to not only the political situation, but then, you know, sometimes I get into all the, you know, start thinking about the things that are wrong in my life, and it sort of, you know, branches off from there, basically.
Yeah, so
short version.
Right. In other words, you wake up thinking, oh, this could happen, oh, that could happen, and I might as well just stay in bed.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Okay, so what I'd like to suggest, Pete, is that you borrow, or you can even steal it if you prefer. This is part of Loretta's strategy. If that's okay with you, Loretta?
Oh, definitely. And let me let you know something, Tom. You're part of my day, man. I
know. Oh, well, that's...
You are serious.
That's sweet of you.
I emailed you the other day and told you I bought 2 Lifetime Sirius radios.
Oh, God bless you.
That is paid up as full, and I let them know.
Thank you.
Because of you and Mike Malloy.
Well, thank you. But back to this.
I tell you, you're number one.
I appreciate that. And see, that's what keeps...
You are so positive. I love you.
Well, that's what gets me up in the morning every morning is the fact that I'm going to interact with folks like you, Loretta, and you, Pete. And so what I'd like to suggest is, Loretta, your strategy is, before you go to bed at night, you think about the things the next day that you're going to look forward to. Now, I'm guessing, Loretta, that there are things in your day that you don't like, that there are people in your world you don't like, that there are unpleasant things that happen from time to time.
I keep away from people like that, and there's really not too many. And if there is, I let them know it.
Well, see, there you go. Okay. So my point is, though, that what you're choosing to focus on, because we all have negative things in our lives and we all have positive things in our lives.
Right.
And Loretta, what you're choosing to focus on are the positives.
That's
correct. And Pete, I would suggest to you that you might want to consider, now here's a person whose primary motivation strategy is moving away from pain, it's become a habit, will probably try to change their strategy by creating a moving away from pain strategy to do it. In other words, you would say, oh, well, I've got to stop thinking about negative things that might happen, and so I'm going to figure out a way to punish myself if I think about them. And what I'm suggesting is a radical change. Instead of doing that, just allow yourself to think about, and in fact, you have the resource for doing this, Pete. You've done it before many times in your life, I'm sure, of knowing that there's something out there that has a positive future that you want and you're looking forward to.
Sure.
And transfer that feeling of, gee, I'm looking forward to that, to just creating a list before you go to sleep and reviewing it when you wake up of cool stuff that might happen during the day.
Hey, that's a really good idea.
Okay. Try it out. And give us a call later in the week, Pete, and let us know how it worked, okay?
All right, thanks. Peace,
great.
Everybody, and same to you, and thanks, Tom, for doing the show.
Thank you, Pete. And Loretta, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, and happy holidays to you and your
thank
staff,
you.
Okay?
And you too, Loretta, and thank you so much for listening there in Brooklyn. All right, so that's moving away from pain and moving towards pleasure. So how do we take this into politics? Well, here's, for example, moving away from pain. And this is why, you know, it's so powerful and it works for a little while. This, a montage, a collection of things from Bush's speech before the Republican National Convention.
Be afraid, September the 11th. We saw tragedy arrive on a quiet morning.
Just notice the tonality. The tonality is one of punishment and pain.
Evil terrorists, danger, doomed killers. Be afraid. The world will drift toward tragedy.
And this is the speech to his own people, to his buds. This is his speech before the Republican National Convention when they renominated him in 2004.
May God bless you. Evil God, Iraq, darkness, the continuing danger of terrorism. Be afraid. We have fought the terrorists across the earth. Evil. We are staying on the offensive.
So, anyhow, enough of that. I can give you another couple minutes of it, but who wants to inflict that? And that's the point. Over the short term, it worked brilliantly. It scared the hell out of all of us. George W. Bush's moving away from pain strategy, which he probably got from being, you know, this is pure psychobabble, right? Pure speculation. But I'm guessing that probably a large part of his life, he was more punished than he was praised. Who knows? I mean, you know, it might just be that it's, you know, some weird gene or ate too many carrots. But that's typically the situation. People who are punished a lot as they're growing up, rather than praised a lot, internalize that as an internal strategy for motivating themselves. And then when they try to motivate other people, they inflict their own strategies on those other people. Now, flip that around. Here's Franklin Roosevelt. He's talking to Congress. This is a speech before Congress. And first of all, he starts out telling them how they're going to be appreciated by their own constituents if they do what he tells them to do.
If
the Congress maintains these principles. The voters, putting patriotism ahead of pocketbooks, will give you their applause.
So, first of all, he starts out saying to Congress, you know, the voters, you know, this is patriotic stuff. And then he presents a vision. Notice the word forward.
In the future days, if we seek to make secure, we look forward to a world founded upon four essential human freedoms. The first is freedom of speech and expression everywhere in the world. The second is freedom of every person to worship God in his own way everywhere in the world. The third is freedom from want, which translated into world terms.
Now, let me just pause this for a second. The freedom from want. See, want is a negative term, but he's presenting this in a positive frame. He continues.
Means economic understandings, which will secure to every nation a healthy, peacetime life for its inhabitants everywhere in the world. The fourth is freedom from fear.
Here, freedom from fear. Here he is. He's the ultimate moving toward pleasure strategy, employing the core of the moving away from pain strategies.
Which translated into world terms means a worldwide reduction of armaments to such a point and in such a thorough fashion that no nation will be in a position to commit an act of physical aggression against any neighbor anywhere in the world.
And thus, and there the applause line. I mean, there he is basically saying, let's have a world with peace. This is a moving toward pleasure strategy. I'll give you a very, very short example of another example of that after the break. We'll talk about how can we incorporate this in a message, how can our politicians do it, and how can we do it in our interactions with other people. 45 minutes past the hour.
What a wonderful world.
Now, there's your moving toward pleasure strategy. By the way, thanks so much to my producer, David Poole, to Louise Hartman, Alex Goldmark, Julian Sukman, Andrew Dunn, Clay Kaplis, Lauren Kirchner, the folks at Air America who helped make this program possible, make it run. To Ben and Shelby at White Rose Society and RadioPower.org, to Sue Nethercutt and the folks in our chat room, and Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website, our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening to our program. It is much appreciated. So back to this book that we're writing on the air here that'll be out in the fall of next year, Cracking the Code, The Art and Science of Political Persuasion. You'll recall, and this has been a big, you know, a conundrum for a lot of people. I get calls from people saying, you know, I don't understand. Why is it that we could get millions of people on the streets before Bush attacked Iraq? But now we can't get millions of people on the streets. Well, the answer is really easy. When before Bush had attacked Iraq, we were all imagining great pain. Right, the possibility of world war, the possibility of soldiers dying. It was an imagined pain. Imagined pain actually can, particularly things like political pain, much greater than actual physical pain for most people. I mean, that's one of the keys of torture, is creating the fear of the coming pain. It's not the actual pain itself, it's the anticipation of it. And so that moving away from pain strategy provoked millions of us to go out in the street all around the planet. But once the deed was done, once Bush had already invaded Iraq, then we had to start constructing a vision of a world that would work, a positive vision, a moving toward pleasure strategy. because the attempts at, you know, well, let's move away from pain some more, just, you know, just never really caught on because there's, it was exhausted. The horse had fallen over dead. It had been whipped too many times by Bush, by the, you know, the Department of Homeland Security, by the red alerts, by the airport screeners, the whole apparatus of be afraid, be very afraid. So now what you're finding are that are those politicians who are holding a clear and positive ideal, a moving toward pleasure ideal forward, are the ones who are getting elected and who are you know, we're all looking toward. John Kennedy was the master of doing both, and this is the key to it. You have to have both. If you, in a truly effective motivation strategy, there has to be a little bit of moving away from pain and a lot of moving toward pleasure. The little bit of moving away from pain gets people's attention. Not enough to cause, ouch, but more like, huh? And then the moving toward pleasure. And this the speech that I shared with you earlier, the way that he wraps it up, he starts out with moving away from pain and then very quickly segues into moving toward pleasure. Listen to this.
We shall be prepared if others wish it.
There's pain.
We shall be alert to try to stop it.
This is the threat.
But we shall also do our part.
And now we move.
To build a world of peace where the weak are safe and the strong are just.
A positive vision.
We are not helpless before that task or hopeless of its success.
And in fact, he's going to use the word vision.
And unafraid.
Before
we must labor on, not towards a strategy of annihilation, but towards a strategy of peace.
Notice the towards. Right? He starts out, you know, well, if they want this, they'll get it. But we're going to move on. And as soon as you start using that kind of language, that move on, that we're going to look toward, which you also heard Franklin Roosevelt using. Now, Bush, in his speeches, he's trying in a very labored way now to start using forward-looking language. Apparently, you know, Frank once sat him down. But by and large, most of his speeches refer back to a time of pain, 9/11. And these terrorists, they want to hurt us. They want to hurt us, right? We got to stop the guys who want to hurt us. And it always gets back to that. It's always, we've got to stop the pain. Well, it's okay once in a while. In fact, it's useful once in a while to have a little bit of that moving away from pain strategy. But mostly we want it to be moving toward pleasure. So it'd be something like with Social Security saying, you know, we don't want the Social Security system to go broke because we don't want to be back as we were before Franklin Roosevelt put it into place in a situation where one of the leading causes of death among elderly people is that they freeze to death in the winter. But the solution, if we look forward, is really very straightforward. All we do is eliminate that cap on it so that right now people who earn up to $90,000 a year pay Social Security tax. After that, if you earn more than $90,000 a year, you don't pay any Social Security tax whatsoever on your earnings beyond the first $90,000. So if you make $1 million, $5 million, $50 million, or $500 million, none of that is taxed for Social Security. That's crazy. That's not just a regressive tax. That's not even a flat tax. So let's just do away with the cap so that everybody pays the exact same percentage. And what that's going to do is it's going to bring the wealthy and the very wealthy into the pool of Social Security payers. And you do the math on it, the fund will be totally, totally secure forever. It solves the problem. And so as we look forward, we can see, you see, now what we've done is we've given them a storyline so that they can hear it. The audio people can hear it. It's also a story that people can feel in their gut. They can, you know, they get a sense of it. You talk about real examples, make things real, bring people into it. You know, elderly people used to die of hypothermia. And then, plus, we've given a forward-looking vision. That's the way to successfully motivate people in the political sphere. Coming up on the next Tom Hartman program, Monday is Christmas. It'll be the best of program. On Tuesday, we'll be live again, and I'll be challenging conservative John Cox, who's praising Bush's call for an expanded military. And Dennis Kucinich is going to drop by to talk about his 2008 presidential campaign. So come back and visit us. And Monday's going to be a great show also. Right here on the Tom Hartman radio program, your radio support group of, by, and for we, the people of the United States of America, and also this week and next, holding the place here for Al Franken. 57 minutes past the hour. We'll see you next week. Merry Christmas.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.